After 9/11, there was a lot of discussion about what Sharia or Islamic law is and isn't. Here in the United States, it's taken on such a formidable meaning that more than two dozen states have considered measures to formally ban Sharia law's influence in their legal systems. But what is it exactly? According to human rights lawyer and legal historian Sadaqat Qadri, while at least 11 of the world's 50 or so Muslim states have constitutions that acknowledge Islam to be a source of national law, Sharia has been interpreted as diversely as the nations and times in which it has been practiced over the past 1,400 years. In his new book, Heaven on Earth, A Journey Through Sharia Law from the Deserts of Ancient Arabia to the Streets of the Modern Muslim World, he illuminates this evolution from the time of the Prophet Muhammad to the present day. The book is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm pleased to welcome Sadaqat Qadri to our show today. Hello.
Hi there.
Now, your first book, The Trial, A History from Socrates to O.J. Simpson, was a history of Western criminal justice, and now you've taken on the history of Islamic law. Should I look on these two books as companion volumes?
Well, I think they are, in fact. I mean, that wasn't the intention, but I started writing the first book back in 2000, and I came to New York, in fact, to write it. I had an American publisher. I wound up living in an apartment in downtown Manhattan. The selling point was that it had a view of the World Trade Center. This is in July 2001. So I was here, actually, literally in Manhattan on September the 11th itself. And I was as shocked as anyone. I mean, I went down to Ground Zero on that day. I was horrified. But I kept to my subject. I mean, my subject was Western jurisprudence. It was looking at Western legal traditions from classical Athens to the present day. But then I wound up, everyone was talking about Islam. When I got back to London in April 2005, we had what we call the 7/7 bombings in London. And again, those were committed by men who claimed to be acting in the name of God. They were Muslims who claimed to be acting in the name of God. So even though I'd written about Western jurisprudence in the first book, I thought to myself, well, what is this Islamic jurisprudence? What is this Islamic law that they're talking about? And that's what first started me off into thinking about wanting to find out more about the history of Islamic jurisprudence.
Even though you grew up in a family that had roots in India and Pakistan.
Sure. I was born a Muslim. I consider myself a Muslim, but I didn't know what the Sharia was myself. And I spoke to my father. I asked my father, well, you know, these guys say that they're acting according to Islamic law when they kill themselves and blow themselves up. What are their arguments? You know, clearly, obviously, he didn't think that they were right. I didn't think they were right, but I wanted to know, well, how do we know that they're wrong? He didn't know the answer.
The debate actually began earlier, as far as my experience is concerned, when Salman Rushdie a bounty was put in his head by someone who issued a fatwa against his life, again citing Sharia law.
Sure. I mean, that was Ayatollah Khomeini. I mean, actually, I was in the United States again when that happened. That was Valentine's Day, 1989. I remember that well. I mean, that was the Iranian Revolution, and a lot of crazy things were happening in Iran during the 1980s. But it just seemed aberrant. I just thought, well, this is one guy's opinion, clearly, and it's an extremist. But yeah, that's a good place to date it as well.
Does the American legal system intersect with Sharia? Should those states that have proposed banning Sharia's influence on their legal systems have been concerned?
Well, I mean, there are very, very, very good reasons to be concerned about Islamic extremism. I'm concerned about Islamic extremism. That's the main reason why I wrote this book.
But that's different than Sharia law.
Yeah, sure, exactly. I mean, the Sharia, as far as a devout Muslim is concerned, the Sharia is what its Arabic meaning is. It means a path. In the 7th century, it meant a path towards water. A route towards salvation, in other words. It's got almost precise Jewish equivalent, the halacha, the path to be walked. And so it's a spiritual concept rather than a list of rules. I talk about in my book, I mean, I kind of romp through 1,400 years of history in the first half of my book, and I'm, you know, telling stories from Baghdad in Arabian Nights time and the Mongol invasions, Genghis Khan. All of these historical events have gone to create Islamic law, And they've also provided some backing, some justification for extreme interpretations of Islamic law, which have come to the fore today. And it's those extreme interpretations which states should be targeting if they're genuinely concerned about extremism. Otherwise, by simply targeting the Sharia, what you're doing is saying to a religious Muslim, we are targeting the way you want to practice your religion.
But is there a singular code of law that we can refer to when we say Sharia?
No.
Because some of the clerics that you research for the book warn you about how they thought laws are interpreted incorrectly in other parts of the world.
Sure. I mean, when I went to one of the countries that I visited during my research was Iran. I spent a month there just before the elections of 2009 that returned Ahmadinejad to power. The first cleric that I spoke to was in the context of a discussion about European veil bans, not about Iran, but about European veil bans. And there were a lot of people around a table. Everyone was listening very politely to two European academics who'd gone there from Ireland to tell the Iranians that in Europe certain governments were thinking about banning Muslims from wearing veils. And I kind of listened to this with a sinking heart. I mean, I think the veil bans are ridiculous and wrong, but I thought to myself, hang on, I know what's going to happen here. I'm in Iran. People are just going to complain about Western double standards and Western hypocrisy, etc., etc. And the first thing that happened, a guy put his hand up. He was what's known as a Sayyid, a descendant of the Prophet. He's wearing a black turban, long white beard, and I thought, here it comes. And he said, well, thank you very much for the presentation. Perhaps in Europe they don't understand the importance of modesty in Islam, but that's Europe. We're not in Europe now. We're in Iran. And why in Iran do we force women to wear to wear hijab? That's contrary to the Sharia. We may as well force Muslims to pray. You know, and I've certainly met a few Muslims who do believe that the Sharia should require people to pray. But, you know, this guy was saying that it was against the Sharia to make women do anything. You know, so there's plenty of interpretations, even within a country which from the outside looks as repressive as Iran.
Aren't there so many, a lot of different things that are never even mentioned in Sharia that people say are cited in the Sharia laws? Another one would be female circumcision.
Sure. I mean, so there are plenty of customs which are dignified by scholars, by some scholars, a minority. I should stress all these. When I talk about scholars, I'm talking about minorities very often. But there are a minority of scholars in North Africa particularly who do say that female circumcision is part of the Sharia. In fact, it was a pagan practice, a pre-Islamic practice. Clearly it lived on, because we can see that it lived on. It lives on as a custom in parts of North Africa, not in other parts of the Muslim world, interestingly, but in parts of North Africa. And it also spans religions. It's not Muslim. It's not specifically a Muslim thing. It's a Christian thing as well. And there are some people who say, well, this is part of the Sharia. I say it's not. And the overwhelming number of scholars over the last 1,400 years would agree with me.
Now, this is not unique to Islam. We see the incorporation of pagan customs into various Christian practices and throughout Europe, for example. Now Catholicism in Africa is becoming a synthesis in some ways. Again, in Latin America, we've seen the incorporation of African religions into Catholicism.
Sure.
So is this just something that we can expect to be naturally occur in a religion like Islam, which covers such a wide swath of the world?
Sure, it's an entirely natural phenomenon. There's nothing.
But everybody claims that their interpretation is the correct interpretation.
Well, there are plenty of people who recognize that that their interpretations are bound by time and place as well. I mean, there's plenty of liberal voices in the Muslim world, but there are certain people, certain hardliners, who do say that this is eternal and universal. I mean, what I try to do with the book is try and retrieve some actual history rather than these kind of theorized traditions which are so often substituted for the actual facts of history.
So you did library research, but then you also traveled around the Muslim world.
Mm.
And that was important for your research. Where did you go?
Sure, that was important for my research. It was important for me personally as well. I started in my dad's hometown. He's born in a town in northern India called Badayu, and that's how the book begins, because I'd always been fascinated by one particular aspect of that town ever since I was a kid. I'd heard then, when I was a teenager, that if you were possessed by a genie, you would go to one of the shrines. There are 7 Sufi shrines in this town. It's a very, very sacred town as far as North India's Muslims are concerned. So you'd go to one of these shrines and you'd be cured. But it turned out that you weren't just cured. You were cured according to the Sharia, as far as these North Indian Muslims are concerned. Because as far as they're concerned, jinns are just as much subject to the Sharia as human beings are. You know, and this is, I just thought that this was, I mean, it's a colourful example, which is obviously why I use it to start the book. But I also thought that it was a useful example to show audiences who aren't familiar with Islamic law just how broad its reach can be.
So these are exorcisms?
These are exorcisms, yeah.
Are they similar to the exorcisms we see in some parts of the Catholic Church?
Well, I mean, the idea of exorcism is certainly similar. I mean, they're not violent or anything like that. I mean, what you see is you see distressed families who are going, distressed poor families who don't really have any other hope, who go to these shrines and who basically pray to be released. You know, and sometimes their next their relative gets better, sometimes not. If they get better, they say it's the Sharia. If nothing happens, then they say, well, that's God's will.
Who did you talk to on your travels? And what was their reaction when you said that you were writing a history of Sharia law?
Well, I talked to all sorts of people everywhere I went. I talked to plenty of human rights activists and ordinary Muslims that I'd meet in mosques or just in cafes on the street. But I thought it was important that I talk to scholars who make it their business to interpret Sharia law. So in northern India and in Pakistan especially, but also in Iran, I went to these the madrasas and these seminaries to talk to people. And I mean, one of the first people that I met was he listened to me very politely when I told him what my plan was. I said to him, well, you know, I've done a lot of research, but of course I'm only human. I only have limited knowledge, so I'm going to talk to many people to find out what the Sharia is all about. And, you know, people with even contradictory opinions, and he looked at me very solemnly and nodded, and he said, you've chosen a very difficult task, and no one should embark on a journey such as yours without knowing their destination first, you know, which I thought was completely ridiculous, the idea that you have to know where you're going before you even start going there.
But he also said any attempt to understand the Sharia required a fluency in classical Arabic and proficiency in Quranic exegesis, and any questions you had in your mind were therefore at least a decade premature.
Yeah, I mean, there was this idea that you've got to know about the Sharia before you can ask questions about it. You know, which just didn't make that much sense to me. I mean, I'm aware of my ignorance, I'm aware of my failings, but you know, the large majority of Muslims that I spoke to before writing this book had no idea what the Sharia was themselves. You know, and if there's that much ignorance about, then it's surely open to someone who's kind of reasonably intelligent and who's got the time to put in a certain amount of research to do it for themselves.
But what was his point? That you first just read it all and memorized it, and then later you asked some questions?
Yeah, that was his point. I mean, the subtext of his point was, why don't you just let me tell you what the Sharia is instead?
Now, others came across as hostile to your inquiries, assuming that you had an agenda.
Yeah, well, you know, let's not forget that I'm these countries that I'm traveling in, Pakistan especially, is on the edge of a war zone. It neighbors Afghanistan, and they have been on the edge of a war zone now for 30 years, because as far as they're concerned, the war in Afghanistan didn't start in 2001. It started with the Soviet invasion in 1979. And so there was a lot of suspicion about me as a Westerner coming in there and asking them about things like blasphemy and things like jihad. And they were like, well, why are you asking us about this? Why don't you ask us about what the West does, you know, about drone attacks and about Guantanamo Bay and things like this? You know, these are things which are clearly important, and I've written a little bit about Guantanamo, certainly.
A different book.
It's a different book, exactly.
You also had to differentiate between Sharia and fiqh.
Mm.
Fiqh is
an Arabic word which means understanding, and there's a crucial distinction between the Sharia, which is the spiritual concept of the path that you should follow to get to salvation, and fiqh, which is human attempts to understand that path, human attempts to discern that path. You know, it's the difference really between God and man. It's the difference between heaven and earth, and that's what my title alludes to. Muslims, a devout Muslim will very often say, look, don't argue with me about the Sharia, because the Sharia is a sacred concept. But fiqh, You can argue all you want about human interpretations of the Sharia. There are very, very few Muslims that I met who believed that every human interpretation of the Sharia was correct. It's impossible to believe that. It's literally impossible because they're so contradictory and there's so many of them.
Including in the Quran itself, because the Prophet contradicted himself a few times.
Sure. I mean, even according to absolutely orthodox Islamic historiography, the Quran is revealed, and this is of course what Muslims believe. The Quran is revealed over a period of 20 years, and during that 20 years, there's a lot of changes to that come through to the Prophet from God, and now it's got to be there's an entire way of understanding the Quran, which scholars use. It's a word called naskh, abrogation, which says that certain verses of the Quran have been superseded by other verses. It's got to be said that that has allowed for some pretty hostile and bellicose interpretations of the Quran, but it also means that even the most devout and orthodox Muslim scholars will accept that you've got to contextualize the Quran historically.
My guest is Sadaqat Qadri, K-A-D-R-I. His book, Heaven on Earth, A Journey Through Sharia Law from the Deserts of Ancient Arabia to the Streets of the Modern Muslim World. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Are Western readers your primary audience for this book? The reason I ask is because some of your footnotes and sidebars seem to be addressing Muslim readers and their potential concerns over what you've written. For example, the first time you mention the Prophet Muhammad, you note that it is, quote, conventional among Muslims to add, may God bless him and grant him peace when referring to him. And then you say this book does not use the phrase, although in case anyone thinks otherwise, no disrespect is intended.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, obviously Western readers include plenty of Muslims. So I'm addressing it to both non-Muslims and to Muslims. My reason for putting those things in isn't because, as some people have suggested, I'm somehow frightened of my co-believers or I don't want to offend them. I certainly don't want to offend anyone. I haven't written my book to offend people. But on the other hand, I'm not going to pull my punches either. And I certainly hope that I haven't done that in my book. I'm extremely critical of interpretations of Islamic jurisprudence in many parts of the Muslim world. But what I don't want to do is lose my audience at the beginning, you know. And so things like that, I mean, they're taken very seriously by devout Muslims. And if it takes that footnote to get them to keep reading, then I'm going to make that footnote.
Before you share your stories from the road, the book lays out the historical events that affected the development of Islamic law. But it seems as though you've outlined the entire history of Islam as one inseparable from the other?
Yeah, pretty much. And also I thought you can't really expect people to understand the Sharia without understanding the disputes and schisms that, for example, caused the division between Sunni and Shia after the Prophet's death. The wars of expansion that were fought as Islam turned from a desert oasis culture into an imperial civilization, those resulted in all sorts of new rules about how you should live alongside peoples that they weren't even known at the time of the Quran. The Mongol invasions, when I started the book, I had no idea that Genghis Khan was going to figure in my story, but it turns out that Genghis Khan and his descendants are absolutely central, far more important in many ways to Muslim history than the Crusades were, for example.
But they weren't Muslims, were they?
No, they weren't Muslims. They came in, they stormed through the Muslim world in the 1400s, from the 1200s and the 1300s, and as a result of their invasions, entirely new ideas about holy war were born, ideas about self-defense, and you know, and they've been revived to deadly effect in recent years. In Osama bin Laden's fatwas, he talks about the Mongols. He compared in the 1990s George Bush and Dick Cheney to various obscure Mongol generals. You know,
well, one of the big mistakes that some American politicians have made is to use the word crusade,
sure.
Which reminds a lot of people of something quite different from what the word was intended in that use.
Sure,
but Muhammad had an edict that the killing of a single person is tantamount to the murder of all humanity.
Sure.
And that's always confused non-Muslims. I mean, how do we wind up with holy war right after he dies? And then the jihadis today killing people, in some cases, totally innocent people.
Sure. Well, in many cases, totally innocent people. Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that Islam is by no means unique as a religion to justify violence under the trappings of religious doctrines.
Thou shalt not kill is one of the commandments.
Sure, is one of the commandments, and the very idea of just war is from St. Augustine, you know, the 5th century North African bishop. And the Crusades themselves, as you've mentioned, I mean, that was a holy war fought in Christianity's name. That is in the past. The important thing, which I certainly recognize in the book, and which anyone sensible would point out, is that, well, the Crusades were in the past, and whereas you've got people saying jihad, the obligation to struggle, actually justifies violence and brutality today. One of the crucial things that I try to show in the second half of the book is that these harsh and violent interpretations of the Sharia are actually very, very modern developments. You go back 40 years to 1970, there is not... The only country in the world that claimed to apply the Sharia was Saudi Arabia. It was only during the 1970s that it began to spread, and it wasn't religious... It wasn't a religious cleric who was the first person to institutionalize provisions of Sharia. It was a general in North Africa by the name of Colonel Gaddafi. Not a religious man, not a particularly religious man, but he was the first person after Saudi Arabia to institutionalize the Sharia.
Then you have
Ziaul-Haq in Pakistan, another general. Then, of course, you have the Iranian Revolution. Then you, in 1979, at the end of the year, you have the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And the point of all of that is that it's coups and its wars and its revolutions and its occupations which are fueling these interpretations of the Sharia. And I mean, war is not a thing which is unique to the Muslim world. I mean, there are plenty of countries which are involved in wars, including, unfortunately, several Western ones.
You're right that even though we see a lot of extreme punishments these days. You said before you started your journey, you had seen footage of a teenage girl being beaten on Pakistani TV for the alleged crime of having spent time in the company of her father-in-law without a chaperone. And when you mentioned the video to the theologians that you met on the road, they all shared a similar response.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this thing had been screened on Pakistan TV. It showed this poor girl, 17-year-old girl, being beaten for having been with her father-in-law. I wanted to discuss it because I just thought, well, you know, this is. I was quite worried about how I'd start talking about criminal justice to these people in these madrasas, and I thought, well, this is kind of almost a tactful way of doing it because, you know, what it is, it's a little beating. And so I kind of raised the subject quite gingerly, and the first thing that I was told was, fake! It's a fake! It's a fake concocted by the Western media. And people were reluctant to talk about this. And very often what I found again and again and again, it was interesting, was that when people did start talking about it, because I did have many conversations with even with hardline scholars about this, and they did justify the penalties. But the flip side of all of that was that, as well as justifying the penalties, or they spent a lot more time, rather than justifying the penalties, talking about the reasons why the penalties couldn't be imposed, how all the evidential requirements that were required. For example, for adultery, adultery, according to some interpretations of the Sharia, not interestingly in the Quran, but some interpretations, you stone an adulterer to death. But the flip side of that is that in order to prove adultery, if someone denies it, you have to have four eyewitnesses to the actual act of penetration. There's a whole branch of Islamic jurisprudence which is devoted to...
So only people who do sex shows could actually wind up being punished.
Well, exactly. And one of the other interesting things that I found out was that in the 500 years of the history of the Ottoman Empire, the total number of adulterers stoned to death was one in five centuries. Now, that's probably the reason, you know, you probably didn't get that many people coming along in fours and saying, we saw the act of penetration. So, you know, there is, but that isn't to excuse to defend the existence of those laws on the statute books, because I think those laws should not exist on the statute books, and I think it's very, very important that Muslims address themselves to the fact that, you know, whatever might or might not have been justified in the 7th century, we're now in the 21st century. And in the 21st century, there are other things which should be focused on, other priorities like unemployment and education, rather than stoning adulterers to death or executing blasphemers. But it is important to say, I think, that in these countries, even though the focus very often falls on these punishments, they're very, very rarely applied. In Pakistan, There's not been a single stoning, not been a single amputation, not been a single execution for blasphemy in all the time that these statutes have been on the all that these crimes have been on the statute books. In Iran, even in Iran, which does apply these penalties, hasn't been an officially sanctioned stoning for 10 years now. Again, as I say, not to excuse the existence of these laws, but to put it into some kind of context.
Although we have seen it in Afghanistan.
Of course, yeah, yeah. You know, informally, not officially, informally, yes, you have. And these interpretations need to be countered.
Sadaqat Qadri is a practicing English barrister, qualified New York attorney. He has written for many publications and is the winner of the 1998 Shiva Naipaul Memorial Prize for Travel Writing. His latest book is called Heaven on Earth, A Journey Through Sharia Law from the Deserts of Ancient Arabia to the Streets of the Modern Muslim World. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We are back with Sadaqat Qadri, who has written a book called Heaven on Earth, A Journey Through Sharia Law from the Deserts of Ancient Arabia to the Streets of the Modern Muslim World. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And before we go any further, I'm still a little confused. Does the word Sharia have a translation beyond Islamic law?
Yeah, the word Sharia literally means a path. And in the 7th century, what it meant was a path towards water. This is desert people. Path towards water is metaphorically means a path, the route that you take to attain salvation. So that's its etymological meaning, and that's the of course it's understood nowadays by plenty of people to imply a list of rules, a list of commands. You know, perhaps even if you're Newt Gingrich, a strategy to overthrow the United States Constitution. But it's a spiritual concept in its original meaning.
Didn't the prophet supposedly received conflicting prophecies over the course of his life? How were they reconciled?
Well, it's a subject of considerable debate and argument among scholars, but there is this doctrine called in English abrogation, an Arabic nasakh, which was developed in the 9th century, about 200 years after the Prophet's death, when scholars were really getting to grips with the text of the Quran for the first time, and they were trying to develop ideas about Islamic law and to build up these rules in the Quran. As I say, the Quran only contained 4 or 5 criminal penalties. So they needed
fornication, false witness, and waging war against Islam. That's it.
That's it. And the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth provision, which allows someone to take retaliation, but then follows it up immediately by saying, but mercy is good in the eyes of God. So you've got these provisions in the Quran, but then afterwards you need to... The scholars get to work on developing new rules suitable for an empire. And in that context, you look at the Quran, and the Quran says, for example, in prayer, there are verses which say that you've got to pray 2 times, a verse which says you've got to pray 2 times, a verse which says you've got to pray 3 times, a verse which says you've got to pray 5 times. Now, with that one, it's pretty easy. It didn't go down. It went up during the Prophet's lifetime. Now, the historians can argue all they want about why that is. You know, if you're secular-minded, then you say, well, that's because of the political pressures that he faced and because of the opportunities that became open to him as and when he gained control of his people. If you're religious-minded, you say, well, that's because God sent down different revelations at different times. But the crucial point is that there are these different revelations, and in the context of peace and war, that becomes particularly important because there's a revelation or a verse of the Quran which emerged later in the Prophet's mission, which talks about destroying infidels. There are many, many, many revelations in the Quran which talk about living alongside infidels peacefully, which pay great respect to Jews and to Christians. There is a revelation which says that infidels should be destroyed. Now,
so you can pick and choose.
You can pick and choose, exactly. But it's important to... Well, there are two things that are important. First of all, the historical contextualization is important. But secondly, what you do with the historical contextualization is also important. Even if it's the case, which seems pretty clearly to be true, that the Prophet did hand down a revelation saying that infidels should be destroyed, meaning pagans, incidentally, not Jews and Christians, pagans should be destroyed towards the end of his mission, is that may have been relevant in the particular circumstances of conquering his enemies in Mecca. And as I say, this isn't Jews and Christians, this is pagans. But it's not relevant, I would argue, in the 21st century.
And he was making exceptions for Jews and Christians because they were living side by side with the new followers of the prophet?
Sure. And, I mean, I don't want to rose-tint this either. I mean, there were problems between...
He had problems with Jews who he expected to join him.
And they did join him at certain points, and then at certain points they didn't. You know, this is a fluid situation in 7th century Arabia. You know, these are tribal wars that are taking place. He had problems with Christians at certain points, problems with Jews at certain points, and he allied himself with both groups at certain points. In subsequent years... As the Islamic Empire expanded, they became the rulers over vast populations of Christians and Jews, and new rules were developed which basically allowed them to coexist far more easily than, for example, Europeans did with Jews in medieval
times.
As we
saw in Spain.
Sure.
But there are tensions at different times. I get the feeling that we have these five basic rules in the Quran. Added to that, intoxication and adultery.
And then
a whole bunch of other things where caliphs would set up rules and then they would somehow be incorporated into the laws?
Sure. I mean, intoxication, according to classical Islamic historiography, and again, you know, the written sources are very rare for this period, and that's something which I deal with more in the book. But according to Muslims themselves, intoxication became punishable as opposed to simply criticized, as it is in the Quran, became punishable in the years after the Prophet's death.
Alcoholic or any kind of intoxication?
Well, alcoholic specifically.
Because drugs are endemic in some parts of Islam.
Sure. No, marijuana wasn't even known in the Muslim world until the 13th century when it was brought over at the time of the Mongol invasions. And then the scholars said, well, actually, of course, it's exactly analogous to alcohol, so therefore the same punishment should apply. You know, that's another example.
But hashish is an Arabic name, isn't it?
Hashish, yes, it is. Yeah, it only appeared in the Muslim world for the first time. It appeared from the east at the same time as the Mongols. The Mongols were in fact blamed for being stoned
opium as well.
Well, I don't know about the precise history of opium, but these other drugs became subject to similar penalties. According to some scholars, there are other scholars who say no, it's only alcohol which is covered. You mentioned adultery. I should point out that stoning is not a punishment which is mentioned in the Quran. In subsequent years, there were people who said, well, actually, that is what the Prophet used to do. He did that on a couple of occasions, so therefore stoning should be the penalty, not the 100 lashes mentioned in the Quran.
I mentioned that some things became part of the whole, all of the laws later. For example, you mentioned early on that the Caliph Umar chose to expel Christians and Jews from the Saudi area, the Saudi Arabian area, and that decision is still used today to justify a citizenship policy that excludes non-Muslims in Saudi Arabia today.
Sure. There's a hadith, a report about the Prophet, which says that the Prophet on his deathbed said that Jews and Christians should be expelled from the Arabian Peninsula.
Now, what's a hadith?
A hadith it means literally report in Arabic. And it's originally an oral tradition about the Prophet. It's the kind of Muslim equivalent of the what would Jesus have done question. And Muslims were in the habit of asking themselves, well, what did the Prophet do in this situation? And these stories were passing around for decades, for two centuries, in fact, before they were actually written down in anything like definitive form. And one of those hadiths says that Muslims and Christians should be, that the Prophet wanted Muslims and Christians to be expelled from Arabia. And it's also said that one of the first caliphs, one of the first rulers after the Prophet, did do that. One of the interesting things that I found out during the course of my research is that even though that is used to justify this discriminatory citizenship policy in Saudi Arabia today, in the 10th century, there's a traveller who went through Arabia, and he commented on the huge Jewish population that existed in part of the Arabian Peninsula in the 10th century.
Now, how does all of this play a role in the schism between the Sunni and and the Shia?
Yeah, it's a very big question. I mean,
the laws apply the same? I mean, are the same laws? Because the Quran is at the center of both versions of Islam.
Sure, the Quran is at the center. The schism originated over a family dispute over who should succeed the prophet. I won't go into the details now because we don't have the time. It might not be of interest to that many of your readers. But
you can find it in Wikipedia.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, basically, of course, the rules are very similar. You get the Quran is regarded as the ultimate source. Hadiths, these traditions about the prophet, are also regarded as important. But there are thousands of these hadiths, tens of thousands of these hadiths, by many records. And the hadiths which the Shia will pay regard to are different in certain respects from those of Sunni. That's not really the most important difference. So the most important difference, I think, is the attitude towards reinterpreting the Sharia. Because even though we associate the Shia with hardline interpretations because of the Ayatollahs in Iran, basically. What the Shia have always done is recognize that there's a historical component to the Sharia and that it changes over time and that scholars can reinterpret it over time. There are some Sunni hardliners who say, no, fixed in stone, can't ever be reinterpreted. And so that's an important distinction.
And in response to an earlier discussion along these lines, I got a couple of messages from Sunnis who said, you can't talk about Shias as Muslims. They are heretics. And
that's an extreme interpretation. I mean, there are very, very few Sunnis who would say that. And of course, there are some extremists who say that, but that's an extremist interpretation.
You write that one of the most celebrated Muslim historians, the 10th century Al-Tabari, noted that tradition held that women were allowed to serve as judges, but by the 12th century, this idea was thought to be an error. Now, did the Prophet say anything about women serving as judges?
Well, you see, this is where the problem of the sources becomes apparent, because there are certainly traditions which say that the Prophet did allow for that. There are other traditions which many Sunnis would now regard as more authentic, which say no, he ruled that out. I'm not writing my book as a definitive guide to absolutely what the Prophet did or didn't say, because I can't know that. What I'm trying to show is the variety of interpretations that there were and the flux that Islamic law was in during the 10th century, during this time that you just mentioned, when it was entirely proper for the most celebrated historian in the Muslim world to say, look, Islamic legal tradition allows women not only to lead prayers but also to sit as judges. And nowadays what you have is you have a bunch of hardliners who say who say we are worshipping tradition, we are venerating tradition, but they ignore 1400 years of actual history, and this is the stories of history that I want to kind of recover with this book.
In your last chapter, you explore the implications of Sharia law in the United States and the UK. Are attitudes about Sharia different in the two countries?
I think there's a certain level of, I'm conscious that I'm a foreigner in the United States saying this, but in certain quarters, there's a certain level of hysteria about the Sharia which doesn't exist in the United Kingdom. There's more understanding of the nuances, but I should qualify that by saying that there are plenty of people. I've been traveling the country now for 2 weeks, 3 weeks promoting my book, and there are plenty of people who aren't like that at all, who are very, very curious about to know more about the Sharia and who also think it's as ridiculous as I think that states are banning this system of law, which actually has had no deleterious consequences at all in practice.
On the other hand, you see many women in headscarves or even more, totally covered in burqas in this country, and
sure,
Nobody says a word. There are variations in all countries. But what happens when laws clash? For example, somebody wants to practice female circumcision in this country.
Criminal offense.
It's a criminal offense here, but at the same time, others will say, well, this is just part of Sharia law.
Sure. Well, I mean, there are people who might say that it shouldn't be a criminal offence. There are people who might say that this is my culture and my custom. I wouldn't be one of those people. I think that it's quite clear that children's rights in those circumstances have to be protected. And I think that if there's evidence of that, then it should be prosecuted as assault, because a child can't consent to something like that.
Well, Jermaine Greer once accused me of being paternalistic because I argued exactly what you just said. She said I was being insulting to people who had these centuries-old traditions.
Right. Okay. Well.
Sadaqat Qadri will be giving a reading and talk tonight at 7 o'clock at the KGB Bar. That's at 85 East 4th Street. You might want to stop by. And his book, Heaven on Earth, A Journey Through Sharia Law from the Deserts of Ancient Arabia to the Streets of the Modern Muslim World, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And I want to thank you so much for coming by. We didn't really cover it all, but I think we've given our listeners a pretty good idea of just how complicated this is.
Yeah, well, it's entertaining as well. I mean, I hope the book shows that. But thank you very much for having me on.